But first, State Representative Jeff Irwin, Ann Arbor Democrat, formally introduced legislation today to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana. So just what would House Bill 4623 mean for Michigan? Representative Jeff Irwin joins us now from the Capitol. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
So tell us, what would your bill do? What would 4623 call for?
House Bill 4623 would decriminalize marijuana in Michigan, and it would mean that individuals who were caught possessing small amounts, up to and including an ounce, would receive a civil infraction rather than a misdemeanor. And as a result, they would be required to pay a small fine rather than face jail time and the considerable fines that are incumbent to a misdemeanor charge.
So how would this work in relationship to federal law, which, of course, we've seen come up when Detroit and Grand Rapids and several other cities decriminalized pot? How would this work, because it's still illegal under U.S. law to possess and use marijuana?
Well, certainly. And if the DEA were operating a sting on, you know, small marijuana users, then they could still be busted under federal law. And this wouldn't change that one bit. But as we know, most of the effort to enforce marijuana laws, most of the money that is spent to enforce marijuana prohibition is spent at the local and state level.
So why do you feel this is the time, and why do you feel this is an issue of concern to people all through Michigan?
Well, this is an important issue for people all through Michigan because we spend a tremendous amount of money enforcing marijuana prohibition. A conservative estimate is around $325 million every year between state and local governments, and that money is spent to arrest, try, and incarcerate marijuana users. Those dollars, a significant amount of money, could be redirected towards more important priorities for our state, growing jobs, investing in our education system, improving our roads, freeing up those public safety resources to focus on violent crimes. Those are all higher priorities for me, and I think they're higher priorities for most of the people here in Michigan. The Pew Center just released data that shows that a majority of Americans support marijuana legalization, much less decriminalization, and 72% of the folks support the idea that we spend more money enforcing this marijuana prohibition than it's worth. So the opportunity to redirect those resources is a big part of it. There's also a philosophical angle to this. You know, this is America. We have a tradition of freedom and liberty here in this country. And I think that tradition is based on the idea that if individuals are engaging in behavior that is a harm to no one but themselves, the government should stay out of that. And, you know, this is an opportunity, really, not only to save a lot of money, but also to accomplish a win for a smaller government.
And I know you've heard this approach from critics, and so I wondered what your response is to critics who say, wait a minute, decriminalizing marijuana will lead to more drug use. Do not open the door.
Well, it's just not true. There are already 17 states in America who have decriminalized marijuana. States similar to Michigan, like Ohio, have decriminalized marijuana, and there has not been chaos in the streets, and there has not been an increase in marijuana use. And what we find from the research is that when people make a decision to use marijuana, it usually is completely disconnected from the criminal penalties that are associated with that use.
Well, how do you get past the stigma then? As you say that it does not bear out that it does lead to more drug use, but where did that stigma come from and how do you get past it?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that getting past the stigma, quote unquote, is the issue. In fact, that might be the best way to encourage folks to engage in healthy behaviors. Look at what's happened with cigarette use in America. We used to have a much higher percentage of people who would smoke cigarettes on a regular basis. And it wasn't so much increasing laws that caused cigarette use to go down. It was really a concerted public campaign to communicate to people the real dangers and real harms of cigarette and tobacco use. So, you know, I think that the best way to make sure that people are acting responsibly is to give them good information and not spend a tremendous amount of money trying to lock them up and run them through the mill of the criminal justice system.
I have to wonder, just free associating here, what do you say to those who say, oh, surprise, surprise, here's a representative from Ann Arbor, famous for the hash bash, home of some of the most lenient laws on marijuana possession in the entire nation, introducing this legislation to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana? He's only doing it for those constituents. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I would encourage them to look at the list of co-sponsors we have on this legislation. We have co-sponsors from all over the state, and we have co-sponsors from both political parties. And like I just said a moment ago, there really is an opportunity on this issue to bring everyone together around a more sensible and sober policy around marijuana laws. And so that's why we're seeing even very conservative legislators who believe in small government, who believe in getting government out of our bedrooms and out of our homes, jumping on board this idea. So there really is an opportunity here for both parties and rural and urban areas to come together and pass a policy that makes more sense for Michigan. And it also stands on the shoulders of so many local initiatives all across the state that have enacted decriminalization policies at the local level.
You have said many legislators will say one thing in private about marijuana decriminalization and then don't want to go public. They're too shy to go public with their support. Why is that, and what do you think it will take to turn that?
Well, I just think that a lot of folks who stand for election are, you know, risk averse, and they don't want to get out in front of the public on issues that are controversial and exciting. You know, I think that is the concern that many of my colleagues have. Many of my colleagues understand that marijuana prohibition has been a huge failure. Most of my colleagues understand that our current policy is not working. But to come out publicly and propose a specific different option has risks, and the benefits are pretty small. And I can tell you that when I say this is an exciting issue, what I mean is that there are a number of issues I'm working on. I'm working on education policy, equal rights for LGBT families. I'm working on environmental issues and clean energy. And it is a real struggle to get attention on those issues. Hmm. But as soon as you start talking about reforming our marijuana laws, people sit up and listen. So I think that's why some of my colleagues are concerned about getting out too far in front of this issue, even though they recognize that our current policy is a complete failure.
So you mentioned you've got co-sponsors, you're getting a reception you seem to indicate is pretty positive from both sides of the aisle. You know that the State House and Senate are Republican-led. Do you think this bill will actually go anywhere?
Well, we're going to have to find out. The bill is going to be assigned to a committee very, very shortly by the Speaker, and then we're going to reach out to the committee chair and see what interest there is in having a really fulsome debate with all of the research on the table about these issues. And I'm hopeful that that will happen. Whether or not we're able to get it through the gauntlet of a House and a Senate and a governor, you know, that's a tremendous challenge, and usually these things do take some time. So I don't want to be, you know, sanguine about how difficult it's going to be to pass this bill, but I do think that it's the right thing to do. I think it's a huge opportunity to redirect these wasted resources towards more important priorities. And I believe that that idea has a tremendous amount of support. Getting the details right and getting the details in order that's going to please everyone around the Capitol, that's going to be a challenge, but we're going to work on it.
And you feel Michigan is ready to decriminalize marijuana?
Well, like I said, the research suggests that the citizens support a more sensible drug control policy around marijuana. And there are a number of communities across the state that have passed similar measures through local initiative. And it's not just Detroit and Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti and Flint. It's also Grand Rapids and Kalamazoo and Traverse City. So, you know, this issue is picking up steam. And I think more and more people are realizing that there's a better way to deal with marijuana than to try to make prohibition work when it's been such a failure for so many decades.
State Representative Jeff Irwin, Ann Arbor Democrat, formally introduced House Bill 4623 today, legislation that would decriminalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Representative.
Thanks for having me on.
When you're a parent, you are making choices for your children day in, day out. And life throws plenty of curveballs at you and your family, whether it's health, financial, emotional challenges. So how do we weather life's challenges? How do you make the right choices for ourselves and those who depend upon us? Michigan writer Robert O'Million's been tackling those key questions in his book, No Fear, No Doubt, No Regret, Investing in Life's Challenges Like a Warrior. It's published by Fern Press of Northville. His insights were hard won as he walked a journey alongside his son, Alan. Alan was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when he was a very small boy, and it was a disease that claimed his life in July of 2010. Robert O'Million joins us in the studio now. Welcome to Stateside, Robert.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Your book tracks your life as well as your son, mm-hmm. Alan's life. Take us back to the early days. When did you first realize that something was not as it should be in Alan's development?
It was early. He was less than 1 year old, and he hadn't walked yet. And we were concerned about that, but, you know, we had a lot of the family members saying, well, you know, don't pick him up so much. He's just, you know, too used to you holding him. But one day, right after his first birthday, he got a really high fever. And we took him to the doctor, and the doctor said, wasn't really too worried about the fever. What she was worried about was she saw a spread in the back where his tailbone is.
Mm-hmm.
And she was concerned about that. That began the journey of just countless doctor's appointments, trying to understand what he really had. And even, you know, to the day he passed away, we never really knew.
You never really knew? Wow.
Well, we knew it was a form of muscular dystrophy, mm-hmm. but what kind, never certain. It was a very aggressive form, though.
So, which meant what? How did it take its toll?
Well, he would walk and run. You know, I had him playing baseball. Even though he would trip and fall, mm-hmm. I still wanted him to experience everything his younger brother was doing. You know, that was the one thing my wife and I decided. He was not going to be left out of a thing. As much as we could do, we were going to have him be mainstream on everything. And that really gave him the courage to believe in himself. So we had him in baseball. We took him to rides. We would be sweating, thinking, is he going to hold on when, you know, he's on these rides? But, you know, he always managed to do it. He found a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then around fifth grade, sixth grade, started falling a lot more. Mm-hmm. We put him in braces. And then finally, eventually, he went into a wheelchair.
He knew that was the ultimate. That was what was going to happen.
Yeah.
So by the time he went to high school, he was wheelchair bound.
He was wheelchair bound and in a motorized wheelchair at that point.
Mm.
But it was when he moved from, and this is interesting about his life story, he was mainstream, always mainstream.
Mm.
But before he was in the wheelchair was the different than when he went into a wheelchair. People's responses to him changed.
In what way?
Well, he was very bright. Mm-hmm. He was always top of his class. In sixth grade, he had to now rely upon some friends to take notes for him because his arms were getting weaker mm-hmm. and he no longer could walk as much. All of a sudden, there was like a mask got ripped off of some parents where now they were wondering, is he getting special favors? Mm-hmm. Because somebody was taking notes for him. And, you know, the rule is when you have to dictate things like he had to with math, he could no longer write it out, mm-hmm. you give them more time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we started hearing comments of, well, how can it be possible that a son or a boy who's in a wheelchair who needs help, how could they be doing better than our children?
Oh, boy.
And so Alan would hear this, and he lived by this one thing. He was not going to be defined by his disease or by his problems. And Alan took the approach, I'm going to make this work. I'm going to be as mainstream as these other people because I like this. I can be challenged by my peers who know as much more than I do. And he wanted that growth experience. He didn't want to be separated from anybody.
And your book, No Fear, No Doubt, No Regret, tracks his course through Catholic Central and then his scholarship to the University of Michigan.
Right.
So he did. He did work hard. He had to do 200% where everybody else might have done 100% just to make sure that people didn't think he was getting treatment.
Oh, it was always that way, you know, that he had to overcome things. But he inspired the boys around him
mm-hmm.
through this. And to this day, there are a couple of special friends who they tell me their life is forever changed by him, by Alan.
Now, as he went through the University of Michigan, his disease was taking a greater toll.
Mm-hmm.
So did he wind up actually graduating?
He graduated, but he never saw his degree
mm.
because there was one class that he needed, and he was really weak at that point. And we tried to ask the University of Michigan, can you waive it? And they were working on it, but he passed away. And to U of M's credit,
mm-hmm.
and they did the most beautiful thing, is they came to the funeral home, one of the directors, and he looked at me, he shook his head, and he said, I got to get that degree for Alan. And he called me back 3 weeks later and said, we have the degree, and we're going to have a special ceremony for him. And they did.
Mm.
A cellist.
Boy.
And refreshments. They brought in professors, people that knew Alan. It was a beautiful, beautiful moment.
I'm speaking with Robert O'Million, his book, No Fear, No Doubt, No Regret, Investing in Life's Challenges Like a Warrior. From your journey with Alan, and what did you are able to spell out what you call 9 insights that will help us recognize, as you say, and act on the blessings we get on a daily basis. And you call that a warrior response. How much of that warrior response did you learn from Alan?
I learned it all from Alan.
Mm-hmm.
It's just right up front. I would not have seen what I've seen in life if it wasn't for him. Mm. Because he taught me that fundamental principle, it's not what happens to you, but how you respond, that defines who you are. And we took that approach almost every situation. And because of his illness, we experienced what it really means when they say the only thing you can count on in life is change. Many of us spend our lives constantly trying to stop change, keep things constant. We feel good that way.
Comfortable.
Yeah. With Alan, as he got sicker and sicker, that was not possible. And it's very uncomfortable to find comfort and a peace in that environment. So what we wound up doing was becoming more aware of what was happening around us. We had no choice. We had to always be open to, all right, how can we get in this building here? Mm-hmm. What kind of adjustment do I have to make to his chair? How can we help him at school so he can still continue to learn? And what we found is, we read about the miracles, and you tend to think you got to be somebody special to see miracles in life or experience special things. Turned out that I think it's in everybody's life. It's right in front of us every day. But you got to be aware of it. And, for me, I had to give up my need as a father to want to control. I couldn't solve it. I couldn't explain it. And most of the time, you just walk away when you feel that way as a man, speaking personally. But Alan taught me another way.
And that was?
It's a contradiction in a sense. I had to give up control to find the alternate way. I had to say, I have no control over this situation. I just have to be now open to what's going on here. And then I started seeing people come into our lives. You'd hear things. Something would appear that, say, where was this before? Well, it was always there. I just wasn't aware of it because I was too busy trying to control and just keep things comfortable.
And by writing your book, No Fear, No Doubt, No Regret, and spelling out these nine insights, what are you trying to tell your readers? What are you hoping people will get from Alan's story and your story?
Well, I wrote it for parents who are going through something similar. When my wife, Gwen, and I were going through this, you're in the action all the time. There's no time to sit back and ponder it. I think if we did sit back and ponder it, we would have just lost it because it's devastating to lose a child. But when you're going through the battle, it's nice to know you're not alone. And I wrote the book for other parents to know you're not alone. And maybe in case you haven't experienced something similar, I want to just share with what I found.
So to someone who's listening to us right now talking, and maybe they are in those early stages of fear at whatever challenge has been thrown at them, what encouragement would you offer them?
There is hope in any situation. And, life is not a marathon. You don't fail because your child gets sick and dies early. You need to just take what you have right in front of you at the moment. For Alan, his best day was yesterday, and we knew that. So we really learned to live in the moment, appreciate him for what was going on right there. How many times I came home from work and I just sat and listened to him and let him talk. And his excitement just was wonderful. And so I guess, pay attention to what you have right now and don't ask the question too much, why is this happening to me? What did I do wrong? Because you didn't do anything wrong. It's just what happens in life. And if you stop and just look at what you have, there's a lot of good there that can make you feel good and give you peace.
And what's the significance of the no fear, no doubt, no regret?
The first night after he passed away, I woke up in a cold sweat, and I heard his voice. I could hear him talking to me. And he said, no fear, no doubt, no regret. That's what I wrote down side of my bed, and I just put it away. And I felt like he was telling me, don't fear the future. Don't doubt anything that happened here, and don't regret what you did for me because I'm okay. That's what I initially felt. When I write in the book, I had 2/3 of it completed, and my original intention was to write my element and then Alan would write his version of the same thing. Well, we never got there. So I had to write a conclusion, and in the end, I put in no fear, no doubt, no regret, which is really past, present, future, mm-hmm. when you look at the words. And it matches the approach I took, which is you got to be a warrior for this. You know, not only a warrior for your child, but for yourself. That's not all over because there's a disease there.
The book is No Fear, No Doubt, No Regret, Investing in Life's Challenges Like a Warrior, written by Robert O'Millian. And where can people find your book, Robert?
It's on Amazon.com. You can go to my website, which is robertomillionbooks.com. And it's at Nicola Books in Ann Arbor. And hopefully I can get it in other places quite soon.
And spread the word.
That's right.
Thanks for joining us
Thank
today
you
on
so
Stateside.
Much. Thank you.
The National Association of Book Entrepreneurs recently awarded Robert's book, No Fear, No Doubt, No Regret, the 2013 Pinnacle Award for Parenting and Family Books. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you are in job search mode, Forbes magazine has a hot tip for you. Grand Rapids. Forbes has put Grand Rapids at number 4 on its list of the 10 best cities to find a job. Just to give you some context, Bethesda, Maryland, Austin, Texas, and Jacksonville, Florida were 1, 2, and 3. So what's behind this and what does it mean, especially for West Michigan? Joining me now with the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, we welcome George Ericchek. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So you've said 2012 was a phenomenal year for Grand Rapids in terms of job growth?
It was. They had 13,000 jobs created in Grand Rapids metropolitan area in 2012. That's a 3.6% growth rate. That's really unheard of. It was a good year. And the jobs were seen in across almost all the sectors. Of course, manufacturing because of the auto comeback, but also in healthcare and professional services and financial services. It was across the board.
So you were totally not surprised that Forbes magazine, put them on that list and it caught Forbes' eye.
Well, I will say that we predicted that 2012 was going to be a good year for Grand Rapids. We did not think it was going to be a fantastic year. That was surprising. We thought that Grand Rapids would ride on the coattails of the auto industry, as the state has. But
right.
Grand Rapids has done much more than that.
So what were some of these factors? As you say, there was certainly the bounce back in the auto industry, but what else is fueling the growth in Grand Rapids?
Well, the other sectors of Grand Rapids are experiencing growth. Healthcare. Now, that's true across the nation, but I think Grand Rapids is becoming more and more of a regional health center. And so I think there's this growing a little bit faster in healthcare than other areas. Then they also got a good boost in insurance and finance sectors as well. And then finally, we can't underestimate the importance of autos because it's not only the auto jobs, and they have auto suppliers. They do not have an assembly plant in Grand Rapids area, but they have auto suppliers. It's the spinoffs. Spinoff jobs that are generated. And so for every auto job, you can expect maybe 1.5 additional jobs. And so a combination of all these events made Grand Rapids have a very good year. And they talk about the fact that the unemployment rate is also 6.6%, which is very low. What's good about that number is it's falling for the right reason. It's some areas of the state, the unemployment rate is falling because people are dropping out of the workforce.
Oh, they're just giving up. Okay.
Yeah. And when you give up, you're not counted anymore. Whereas in Grand Rapids, the unemployed are actually finding jobs. And indeed, their labor force is growing because people who had given up before are starting to come back in.
Now, I do wonder, is there a problem with the remaining jobless folks in the Grand Rapids region? Do they have the right skills for the jobs that are being created, or does some work need to be done in that area?
There does need to be work in that area. There's two challenges still facing unemployed workers. The first one is that many of them, and I mean maybe about 30-40%, have been unemployed for more than 6 months. And that's simply, you lose a bounce in your step. You lose your self-confidence. And worse yet, employers start looking at you like you're damaged goods. And so one of the challenges that Grand Rapids face, as well as the U.S., is the fact that many people who are unemployed have been unemployed for for 6 months, a year, and it's going to be difficult to get them back. Mm. The second is that when we talk to employers in the Grand Rapids area, there is a skill mismatch that they're seeing. They're not getting, they're not seeing the right people that they need for the jobs that they have. So you're right. I mean, right now, I bet if you had you talked to almost any employer in Grand Rapids, they would say that they're having a tough time finding the workers they need.
Boy, it all gets back to that education and training, doesn't it?
It does. It gets back to education, training, but then again, it also gets back that we have to realize this was a very bad recession. It was the Great Recession. And so a lot of people have been unemployed for a long time, and we have to make sure that employers don't discount their abilities simply because of the length they've been unemployed.
Lessons to learn. Meantime, it's like good for Grand Rapids making that Forbes magazine list, and it certainly is good for the whole state when you have some positive buzz like that. Kind of spills over, doesn't it?
It does spill over, and it also shows that more and more economists are saying that places attract talent because they're a good place to live. And I think that when you see the Grand Rapids of today versus what it looked like 5 years ago, if you walk downtown in Grand Rapids with the art prize and other activities, it's just becoming a more attractive location for young professionals as well. And I think that speaks highly of the community.
George Erichek with the W.E.F. John Institute for Employment Research. George, thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week marks an important event in the history of Michigan and the history of Native American tribes here in the Midwest. Chief Pontiac was Anishinaabe, known as the Three Fires Confederacy. Anishinaabe comprises the Ojibwe, Ottawa, and Potawatomi tribes. And 250 years ago this week, Chief Pontiac called an important Council of Tribes. The purpose? Figure out how to drive out the English settlers and army from the Great Lakes and Ohio Valley regions. Hundreds of Native Americans came to Chief Pontiac's council on the banks of the Ecorse River in what's now Council Point Park in Lincoln Park. We are all familiar with the name of Chief Pontiac, if for no other reason than knowing about the city in Oakland County that bears his name and the now discontinued GM car line. But we wanted to learn more about the significance of Chief Pontiac and this council that happened on April 27th, 1763. Joining me now is Ben Hinman. He's the interim director of the Seventh Generation Program of the Saginaw Chippewa Tribe in Mount Pleasant. And Ben is the great-great-great-great-grandson of Chief Pontiac. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to take this opportunity to really talk about the legacy of Chief Pontiac.
So, Ben Hinman, take us back. What was happening in 1763 that compelled Chief Pontiac to call this council meeting?
Well, you know, the primary reason Chief Pontiac was gathering chiefs was he had a vision. Like many of our people at that time, there was a struggle to really protect and preserve our way of life. And Pontiac saw the changes that were happening in his own communities as many Anishinaabe were beginning to adopt Western society practices. They were using muskets. They were wearing some of the clothing. They were trading with the British at that point. And many times the items that they were receiving were things that were not a part of Anishinaabe culture.
Hmm.
So Pontiac was concerned about the whole colonization process that he saw happening.
This all happened after the British basically had won the French and Indian War then, so it really focused on tensions with the British.
Correct. Well, you know, the interesting thing is people first need to understand who Chief Pontiac was. First and foremost, Chief Pontiac was one of the grand chiefs of the Madewiwin Healing Lodge. And as a member of that lodge, they were really about peace and reconciliation. They were many times approached between, there were disagreements between Anishinaabe, who were members of the Three Fires Confederacy, to find ways to resolve matters without violence. Mm. And so, you know, a lot of his focus at that time, even though he was also recognized as a great war chief because he was a great strategist, he was also a very spiritual man. And he spent much of his deliberations working within that structure and actually had to seek permission at every stage of his decision-making process from the elders of the Madewiwin Spiritual Society.
So there they are. He sees encroachments being made daily on what had been the way of life, seeing people become more westernized, tensions growing with the British. So what led to the idea of a council? And was this a first?
This was a first. And, you know, the formation of the Three Fires Confederacy was really based on the notion that as Pontiac interacted with the British and the French, he saw the importance of building alliances. I think one of the most amazing things he did was he discovered what some historians refer to as the middle ground. And what that means is that he found and realized that there was a common threat not only to the Anishinaabe that were living in the Great Lakes, but to every Anishinaabe nation across the country. And he used that middle ground as a way to really begin to focus on what was happening and talking about the loss of way of life. He was completely dedicated to the notion of preserving the Anishinaabe beautiful way of life. And in that way of life, he saw balance. And he knew that it had worked for thousands of years for the Anishinaabe. And, you know, they were living a good life prior to contact with the British. You know, they were looking at, you know, there are three things that that comprise our cultural identity. One of them is language. And, you know, he was concerned about the loss of language. He was concerned about the loss of land. I mean, that was one of his biggest concerns was that we were losing homelands. And then the third aspect, of course, is spirituality, a part of his life that was very important. And he saw the effort to begin to also bring in other spiritual beliefs, Christian beliefs. And some of the even during that period, there was an effort to begin to convert Anishinaabe to Christian values and beliefs.
We've seen that going back to the 1600s with the French Jesuits coming into Canada. So, yes, that was certainly a part of that. So he calls this council. They gather April 27th, 1763. How many came from how many tribes?
You know, I don't think anybody has an accurate count of the number of chiefs were present. Here's what we do know. All of the Anishinaabe from the Great Lakes region, all of the chiefs from the Great Lakes region gathered. We also know that, you know, you had the Sac and Fox in Ohio. You had the Onondaga and the Oneida in Pennsylvania and New York. And we had tribes from chiefs from as far away as New York who attended this council.
Hmm.
And, you know, the interesting part of this, and I guess a part that I should talk about a little bit, at about the time that Pontiac was talking about his concerns about the Anishinaabe way of life going away and leaving us and the impact that it would have on tribal people, there was an important Anishinaabe spiritual leader, a prophet, to some extent,
mm-hmm.
who had a vision, and his name was Neolin. Neolin, when Pontiac learned about the vision of Neolin and how much it mirrored his own concerns and beliefs prior to that meeting at the Encourse River, he actually went and met with the spiritual leader, and they discussed his vision. And his vision, like Pontiac's, talked about the destruction of the Native American way of life. And so, you know, he invited Neolin to come and present his vision to the Anishinaabe that were assembled for this meeting on the Encourse River. And it really was a big part of his message to these chiefs was that, you know, this is prophesied to happen. This is something that one of our great spiritual leaders has seen.
So it's time to take action now.
So it's time to take action. We've used diplomacy. We've negotiated agreements. And we've seen them unilaterally violate these agreements.
And as it turned out, he was absolutely 1,000% right. Now, Ben, ultimately what we call roughly as Pontiac's Rebellion began that year in 1763, coming out of that council, lasted for 3 years. Lives were lost, settlers, British Army, and I've seen historians write of violent murders, bodies of victims scalped and mutilated and put on display, kind of a psychological warfare. So I guess it comes down to desperate measures for desperate times.
You know, there's all this notion that Anishinaabe people were taking scalps, but that really wasn't a part of our culture. It wasn't something that we practiced. A lot of those atrocities really were happening on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think history, if you take a look historically, what happened in the United States for up until the late 1800s, early 1900s even, the United States actually had offered a bounty for Native American scalps. Many times when that was happening during these wars, it was really in retaliation to what had already been done to Native Americans.
I'm speaking with Ben Hinman. He's the interim director of the Seventh Generation Program of the Saginaw Chippewa Tribe in Mount Pleasant. And Ben is the great-great-great-great-grandson of Chief Pontiac. It was 250 years ago this very week that Pontiac called a council of tribes, and they met in what is now Council Point Park in Lincoln Park. Ultimately, Ben, what was Pontiac's legacy?
Whenever Anishinaabe people are addressing each other, when he assembled with these chiefs, one of the signs of respect that we used at that time for each other was that we addressed each other as brothers. And in our language, a brother was indicating that we were equals. And in his message to the chiefs that were assembled on the Uncourse River, that was part of his discussion, talking about the fact that the British, you know, by violating these agreements, were treating us like children. And he was saying in that message that they don't consider us even their equals, even though they meet with us and construct these agreements. Following the war that waged for close to 3 years, or just a little over 3 years, the British finally realized that they were going to have to begin to treat the Anishinaabe with a degree of respect because they'd been so successful in laying siege to so many of the important forts that they had established. All but two of the 10 or 11 forts that were laid siege by Pontiac and his allies fell to Pontiac's rebellion. And, you know, following that loss, the British requested that Pontiac meet with them to sign another agreement. And that agreement happened in the form of a treaty. This is one of the earliest, if it wasn't the first, time that a foreign government was really signing a treaty with Native Americans.
Acknowledge them as a nation.
As nation to nation. And, you know, that the legacy that comes out of that, of course, is that a short time later, when the United States is beginning to develop its relationship with Native American tribes in North America, in what's now the United States, George Washington and Henry Knox, who was the first Secretary of War, were working very closely together. And even Knox realized that sitting to the north were two powerful chiefs by the name of Pontiac and Tecumseh. And they had been very successful in organizing a rebellion that had defeated the British. And sitting to the south, you had another powerful chief who had about 10 to 15 tribes that were willing to follow him into battle. And so militarily, what happens is, out of that respect for the leadership of Anishinaabe nations, the legacy is that the United States also follows that model and begins to treat with tribes on a nation-to-nation basis. And so all the way up through 1871, when the treaty-making period really ended, the model, the legacy that is left behind by Chief Pontiac is that nation-to-nation acknowledgement.
And Pontiac ultimately was assassinated in 1769.
Yes. Yes, he was. You know, unfortunately, anytime you're a central figure like this in any culture, and you've been part of writing history, you always have those who are detractors from the work that you've done. And, you know, traveling in the in Illinois country, he was attacked and assassinated. Mm. And it was a great loss to the Anishinaabe because, you know, his predictions about what would happen over the next couple hundred years would come true. We would see the introduction of the Indian boarding school system and the forced removal of children from their communities and homes. It was a process of colonization. It was a process of assimilation.
And we should note, your mother and grandparents went through the boarding school system. In fact, the nuns wanted you to go into the seminary to train to become a priest, but you ended up leaving the boarding school system and you got connected with a traditional Native family in Sault Ste. Marie. You began attending powwows and you really connected back to your roots. And now you help preserve your Anishinaabe heritage. You teach others in your role as the interim director of the Seventh Generation Program of the Saginaw Chippewa Tribe. You're in Mount Pleasant. Talk to us about the idea of this seventh generation philosophy. And it's important because you actually are the seventh generation away from Chief Pontiac.
The seventh generation philosophy is really a system for making decisions in tribal nations. And what it says is that, you know, we bring with us the seven the knowledge and wisdom of the past seven generations, and we should respect and follow those teachings that are given to us. But it also says that every decision we make today will impact our children and theirs for the next seven generations. And in that belief system, it means that anytime we were deliberating decisions that would impact our people, we had to take that into consideration. And, you know, as part of that philosophy, we were respectful and listened to everyone to make sure that we were considering how it impacted everyone.
Hmm. Finally, I'd like to get your thoughts, if I could, Ben. What would Chief Pontiac think of life for Native Americans in Michigan in 2013 if he could be talking with us today?
I think he would be saddened because many of the things that he talked about in his own vision came to realization. And, you know, in his lifetime, there were young Anishinaabe, and I talk about this a lot when I'm talking to our young people. There was a time when every young man in our community, when they were walking into ceremonies, when they were a part of the community, they knew exactly what their role was and what to do. And sadly today, you know, because of the assimilation policies, the impact of colonization of our communities, the establishment of the Indian boarding schools, we've seen tremendous loss of our cultural teachings and beliefs. In fact, it wasn't until 1978 that the United States passed the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. And for the first time, Anishinaabe teachings and ceremonies, which had moved pretty much underground, were beginning to surface again. And, you know, a lot of that came out of also the awakening that was happening during the 1970s. But I think Pontiac would be saddened to see where things have gone, to see that his vision, despite the fact that he fought and gave his life to protect it, still happened. I think it would be difficult for somebody from that period, any Anishinaabe from that period, to understand how that could happen.
Ben Hinman, he's the interim director of the Seventh Generation Program of the Saginaw Chippewa Tribe in Mount Pleasant, and Ben is the great-great-great-great-grandson of Chief Pontiac. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Been a pleasure to speak with you as well.
And this weekend, the public's invited to commemorate that 250th anniversary of the Council of Tribes. There'll be a powwow Saturday and Sunday at Council Point Park in Lincoln Park. And a new Michigan historical marker will be dedicated at 5 p.m. Sunday. The Lincoln Park Historical Society and Museum and American Indian Movement of Michigan holding the free events open to 1 a.m.